Our second case this morning is United States against NIRAD. It's a certified case. The government's the appellant. The government may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Weber, and I, along with Colonel Douglas Cordova, represent the United States in this matter. There are some places where even the proverbial 800-pound gorilla is not free to roam. Judge Wiss's concurring opinion in United States v. Parker recognizes that even the courts of criminal appeals have limits on their Article 66C authority. In this case, the Air Force Court pole vaulted over that limit, past the line drawn by this court in cases such as Tardif and Claxton and Quiros, and well beyond the discretion envisioned by the drafters of the UCMJ. The Air Force Court legislated from the bench, cloaking a disagreement with Congress in Article 66 terms. And, Your Honors, I want to talk about issues today like the language and legislative history of the Article 66, the role of commanders, and the other areas, of course, that you have questions on. But before I do this, I think it's important to lay out exactly what's on the table, what's exactly at stake here. If the published decision below is allowed to stand, the service courts become something much more even than an 800-pound gorilla.
That's a legal policy argument. What's your legal argument?
Well, sir, that is a legal argument in the sense that the absurd result reached here.
Is this a plain text case, a legislative history case, a case law case? What kind of legal case is this?
Yes, sir.
What's the essential legal argument that you want us to focus on?
The essential legal argument is that the drafters of the UCMJ, as evidenced by the legislative history, could not have envisioned the result reached in this case, could not have envisioned that the Courts of Criminal Appeals have the authority purported to be exercised in this case.
Well, counsel, if this is a case of statutory construction, and I think that's where this case has to start, can you take a look at that second sentence in Article 66C, which is the sentence that we are here today to try and figure out what it means? And can you kind of go through that sentence and show how those plain words support your argument that and essentially I think what we're talking about here is whether or not through this language, Congress gave them equitable powers not only in sentencing but also in findings.
Yes,
and so what I'd like to hear from you is your arguments as to why that sentence does not give that power to them.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the language of that sentence, and of course the sentence you're referring to, it being the Court of Criminal Appeals, may only affirm such findings of guilty and the sentence or such part of the sentence as it finds correct in law in fact and determines on the basis the entire record should be approved.
And it should be approved is what
we're
looking
at. Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there are two main reasons why that language does not answer the question of the limits of the Courts of Criminal Appeals authority and why we have to look to the legislative history. First, it's not entirely clear what should be approved refers back to. Does it relate back to findings? Does it relate back to sentence? Does it relate back to both? The construction of the sentence is somewhat awkward in that respect, and it's not entirely clear whether should be approved merely relates to sentence or to findings and sentence.
So your argument is that it's too ambiguous to determine on the face of it, and so we have to go to legislative history.
Yes, Your Honor, that is my argument. My second argument is that should be approved, best case scenario for appellee is should be approved does relate back to findings and sentence. Well, what does should be approved mean? And again, I think that's a sufficiently ambiguous term that we have to look to the legislative history to determine what should be approved means.
But you would agree that the should be approved has been interpreted to mean that the CCAs have this equitable authority as to sentences to do justice.
I wouldn't quite call it an equitable authority. In United States versus Quiros, this court was very careful to say that the courts of criminal appeals are still courts of law, that even making a reasonableness determination, that is a legal standard, not an equitable standard. So I would disagree with the characterization of an equitable authority, but yes, Your Honor, I mean, they certainly do have broad powers under that.
Let's try this. If the Court of Criminal Appeals determines that the sentence is correct in law and correct in fact, can it change the sentence under the should be approved authority?
Yes, Your Honor. So if we...
Using Latin or some other language I don't know, what principle of statutory interpretation are you applying either way to make the argument that the last clause does not relate back to the first clause in its entirety?
Yes, Your Honor. I would merely, without you speaking Latin, that's not a problem for me, the construction of the sentence only says findings of guilty and the sentence, and then it lays out three distinct tests that the court must go through then. It is not just, from the construction of the sentence, it's not clear what correct in law, correct in fact, should be approved, relate back to. That's the primary argument there. And, of course, that's the exact, the government's interpretation, at least that it's ambiguous, if not, you know, on our side, is the exact result that this court reached in United States v. Waymeyer less than 8 years after the enactment of the UCMJ. That was a case where this court soundly rejected the argument that Article 66 allows the courts of criminal appeals to modify findings in the interest of justice. This court held that they may only disapprove such findings as they find incorrect in law and fact. So in other words, they found that correct in law and fact was the only part of that sentence that related back to findings. It was never intended, this court said, that a board of review would be given the power to disapprove findings in its discretion. So at the very least, Waymeyer stands for the proposition that the language is not so plain on appellee's side that we must wholly ignore the legislative history here.
Well, what kind of a concept then is unreasonable multiplication of charges and multiplicity? It seems there that they are going beyond the hard letter of the law, and the CCAs are taking a look at the fairness behind the charges that have been made, certainly an unreasonable multiplication of charges. That authority is exactly what you're arguing right now they don't have.
Yes, Your Honor. It does appear over the decades that there's been a gradual sort of progression, all the while recognizing that there's a line that the CCAs may not cross, but a gradual progression to allowing sort of closer to that line. From Waymeyer and Fleming in some of these early cases to Claxton in 1991 to Tardiff and Quiroz in some of those cases in the early part of this decade, that they are allowed to sort of exercise that reasonableness authority, again, a legal determination, not an equitable one, and of course, as to findings as well, I would say in two things about that, Your Honor. First, the court still recognizes there's a line, that the court below has to engage in a legal determination. They approved of the CCAs, sort of setting out several criteria that they would examine under that legal standard. And of course, the court below could have done that here. I mean, they could have examined this under an unreasonable multiplication of charges framework. I suspect the reason they didn't do so is because they would not have reached the result they wanted, because under that
just
test they would have failed.
Just to be very clear, you are saying they have the authority, would have had the authority in this case to conclude incorrectly or correctly that there was an unreasonable multiplication of charges?
Yes, Your Honor. And
is the government's position that they have that authority?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the reasons in Quiroz why they approved of that sort of special exercise of authority is RCN 307 and the long history in the MCM of approving of that sort of exercise of power. We have the exact opposite here, where there's no approval, implicit or otherwise, throughout the MCM of the court engaging in what we properly believe is termed nullification here.
The way I read the briefs is that you're anxious to get past the text and into the legislative history, and the appellant's anxious to stop at the text. Mm-hmm. You both get to make your own arguments, but I think is it necessary for us to find an ambiguity in the text to get to the legislative history? Or do we look at, because it's the UCMJ, do we look at the whole kit and caboodle without looking at the text necessarily? Or is it all dependent on us wondering what this refers back to, and then you get to your legislative history?
Your Honor, it is not necessary that this court find the language of Article 66 ambiguous. Appellee's brief really seems to put all the eggs in the plain language of the statute, but an equally important rule of statutory interpretation is that the code must be examined as a whole. All the provisions which grant the authority to the commander to compose the court, to convene the court, to prefer and refer charges, to grant clemency in his, quote, sole discretion, those can be examined as well in determining what the language of Article 66 basically is supposed to mean. And where those two cannot be read harmoniously, then again we would have to resort to the legislative history.
What is your strongest, if you hope that we're focusing, because this is a little bit like citing to the Federalist Papers for constitutional interpretation, you tell me what result you want and I'll get you a quote. If you are hoping that we're focusing on your legislative history, if we get to that, what are the sort of two pieces of legislative history you would have us focus on?
First, Your Honor, that we have an abundant amount of legislative history from the enactment of the 1950 UCMJ, and more every day, I might add, is becoming available. Nowhere in the thousands of pages that are available, from the committee reports to the personal notes of Professor Morgan and the Vanderbilt Committee and so forth, nowhere is there any mention of any of the drafters or any of the congressional representatives of granting the courts this sort of equitable power, if you would, over findings.
So the first argument is silent legislative history is your best legislative history argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
About to give me.
Yes, Your Honor. That the absence of any such discussion as to what would be an extraordinary grant of power to the courts is compelling evidence that Congress never intended this authority to be granted. The second piece of evidence I would cite is the repeated testimony of Professor Morgan, obviously the key player in the drafting of the UCMJ. Over and over again, in answers to questions from senators as to what the limits of the Courts of Criminal Appeals authority would be, he cites three components: legal sufficiency, correct in law; factual sufficiency, correct in fact; and sentence appropriateness should be approved. Nowhere does he make any mention of any sort of equitable power or findings. He limits it to those three powers over and over again. And that's consistent with the way both the Courts of Criminal Appeals and this court, in cases like United States v. Lane, have interpreted Article 66, that it contains three components: legal sufficiency, factual sufficiency, and sentence appropriateness.
And in his discussion of sentence appropriateness, doesn't he repeatedly say that the sentence appropriateness power is being given to the Court of Criminal Appeals because of the adverse experience of World War II with convening authorities, and that there needed to be a centralized authority to review what was happening in the far-flung and uncontrolled discretion, otherwise uncontrolled discretion, of convening authorities with respect to the processing of cases?
I would agree with part of that, Your Honor. Yes, he does say that the convening authority's role in the court-martial itself was a problem, and the reason, or at least one of the main reasons why they gave the Courts of Criminal Appeals this power over sentencing, that convening authorities were inserting themselves in the actual court-martial itself, issuing reprimand to court members when they felt a severe enough sentence was not being imposed, and so forth. But time and time again, especially the Vanderbilt Committee, when they went out and they studied what's the real problem in the court-martial system, and they would ask the opinion of general officers, of enlisted members, of judge advocates, and they asked, is there a problem in the role of the commander's discretion to refer cases to courts-martial? Is the commander granted too much discretion there? And the answer was resoundingly no, that there was no problem presented to the committee that they were asked to fix.
I understand that argument, but with respect to the argument that you've otherwise made in your brief, that the government's position is essential because of the importance of the role of command in the military justice structure, my question is twofold. First, doesn't the legislative history rebut that with respect to sentencing? And then secondly, specifically with respect to sentencing, why isn't it much more of a constraint on the authority of the command to allow the Court of Criminal Appeals to preclude the service from discharging someone in a court-martial process? That is, you have to keep someone. The Court of Criminal Appeals is imposing the retention of an otherwise problematic airman on the Air Force. Why is that less of a problem than the Air Force knocking out one of dozens of charges against somebody in a case?
Two points, if I may, Your Honor. I see my time's about to expire.
Let me answer the question.
First, of course, if a court of criminal appeals sets aside, say, a bad conduct discharge because they feel that that should not be approved, that, of course, does not preclude the service from discharging that member. That simply is a characterization as to the appropriate punishment in that case, and the commander can still go through the administrative discharge process. Second, a statement about what an appropriate sentence is affects a given case. Certainly there's some effect on the authority of the commander in that given case, but it only affects that given case. Here, where a court of criminal appeals can overturn a commander's discretion and really overturn an act of Congress and say a broad category of misconduct can no longer be effectively prosecuted, that affects good order and discipline throughout a commander.
With respect, counsel, I believe that's a different argument. That's an argument that the Court of Criminal Appeals has abused its authority by masking a legal decision or a jury nullification language of should be approved. That goes to the abuse of discretion. It doesn't go to whether they have the power in a particular case to invoke the should be approved authority for case-specific reasons.
In that case, Your Honor, I would merely say that Congress decided that clemency was the sole discretion of the convening authority, that the convening authority, in his or her role as commander, would have the sole discretion to set aside a findings or sentence for any reason or no reason at all, and they drew a sharp distinction between that authority and the role of the courts of criminal appeals.
What is the distinction? Draw me a principal line between clemency and appropriateness.
Well, of course, in the sentencing appropriateness arena.
I'm talking about sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, in United States v. Healy, this court really provided that answer where sentence appropriateness is ensuring justice is done, is ensuring that the punishment fits the crime and the individual. Clemency is treating an individual with less rigor than he deserves, or mercy. It's very difficult to draw that distinction in the findings appropriateness arena, if you would, where Congress has already said, and the proper authority has already said, that this conduct is illegal and it should be referred to court-martial. It's hard to imagine any relief granted under findings appropriateness as being anything other than clemency. And if there are no further questions,
you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efron, and may it please the court. Judge Baker, this is a plain text case, but it is also a stare decisis case. If we look at the plain text of Article 66C, it says that the findings that a court of criminal appeals may approve so much of the findings and part of the sentence as it finds correct in law and fact and determines on the basis of the entire record should be approved. So it's clear based on that textual language that the analysis does not end with a finding of factual and legal sufficiency. There is an and therefore a court of criminal appeals does have additional authority.
Full stop, or now let's look at the legislative history and see if we're reading that consistent with the overall intent.
A full stop, Your Honor. In the context of statutory construction, the statutory language has primacy. Recourse to legislative history or other non-textual aids are appropriate only where the statutory language is not clear. And here again, Your Honor, it is absolutely clear that the analysis does not end.
Original intent.
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting to note that of course...
You seem to be arguing original intent and plain text.
We're arguing plain text. It's interesting, Your Honor, to note that, of course, there is one important word change in that sentence of Article 66 since Congress initially adopted it in 1950, and that is the word shall change to the word may. So when this Court was looking at the legislation in Fleming, the legislation said that a Board of Review shall affirm only so much. But now, of course, when this Court looked at it in Tardiff and Claxton, it said a a court of military review in Claston and a court of criminal appeals in Tardif may affirm only. So when we say original intent, there is the question of who is right. The origin that we're discussing, Your Honor. But the textual language answers this question. Therefore, it would be inappropriate to go further than the textual language.
Has this authority been used before? Can you cite the cases where CCAs have used this authority or used it quite so expressly?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and we commend the government. I mean, absolutely commend the government for bringing the McCall case to this court's attention. I mean, we think that's in the highest tradition of the bar, that they found a case that's helpful to us and they brought it to the court's attention, and we appreciate that. So the McCall case is a great example of this, Your Honor. And so what happened in that case was an accused was found guilty of both indecent assault and breaking restriction by a general court-martial. And so on appeal, the conviction for indecent assault was set aside. And so the Navy Marine Corps court is left with the consideration, well, what do we do with this breaking restriction? You know, should this individual have a federal conviction for what would normally be an NJP type offense? And the court exercised its authority to say, we're going to set that aside in the interest of justice. And the final sentence, of course, in the majority opinion in McCall says, this is not clemency. So the court was conscious of the fact that it could not engage in clemency, but it could provide justice. It could do justice, and it did that in that case. And it's interesting that the McCall case came after Claxton. And so Claxton provided an interpretation of Article 66C that we believe is consistent with the plain language of Article 66C.
And other cases to cite?
Well, of course, we also know that the Board of Review, the Army Board of Review in Waymire purported to take an action in the interest of justice. This court in Waymire said that was incorrect. We disagree with the court's reading of the statute in Waymire, but that is another instance in which it then a Board of Review, Your Honor.
So the plain text has not been used very often in your case.
Well, it hasn't been, Your Honor, and there may be a reason for that, and that is because of Waymire, which again we believe was incorrectly decided, and also didn't take conscious effect of the change of the word shall to may that had actually occurred before Waymire was decided. It released on pre-change cases. But after Waymire, Your Honor, first a Board of Review and then a Court of Military Review couldn't do what this court did and couldn't do what the lower court did in McCall because of Waymire, Your Honor. So it wasn't until Claxton reconstrued that language that it freed the courts of military review and now courts of criminal appeals, perhaps I should just say service courts, that it freed the service courts to do what the Navy Marine Corps court did in McCall and what the lower court did in this case, Your Honor. So, and even beyond that, Your Honor, even if the boards of review and then the service courts had been free to do this all along, it's not surprising that this power would not often be exercised. You know, we wouldn't expect the service courts to go around willy-nilly setting aside findings of guilty that they do find to be legally sufficient and factually sufficient. And the lower court in this case emphasized the unique factors. In fact, the lower court used the term unique four times. It emphasized the unique factors about this case that led it to take this very unusual step. And so the fact that this power has not often been exercised doesn't indicate an absence of that power. It indicates the rarity with which this power should be exercised.
Counsel, I presume you're familiar with 10 U.S.C. 1552.
not by number, Your Honor.
The correction board statute.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, the correction board statute. Of course, the correction boards are creatures of the purest equity. A system bound not by precedent but sent out there to do justice. The Correction Board statute contains an explicit prohibition on the board's tinkering with the findings of UCMJ courts-martial. Now, if the correction boards are specifically denied this power, how is it logical to believe that the CCAs have it? One's an administrative board in the executive. The other is a court. Parse that for me.
Well, Your Honor, now we get back to the original intent of the question of whose original intent. Of course, when Congress first provided this power, it was giving it to boards of review. It wasn't giving it to a court, Your Honor. Now, those boards of review have since evolved into courts, but when Congress initially made the decision that to provide this power, it was giving it to a board. And it's very interesting, Judge Baker asked Colonel Weber about his two best pieces of legislative history. Our two best pieces of legislative history, Your Honor, are...
I just hadn't gone to that yet.
Yes, right, but this is helpful in answer to Judge Stuckey's question. It's pages 262 and 263 of the Senate Armed Services Committee's hearings on the CMJ. And that is where Major General Green, the Judge Advocate General of the Army, engaged in a discussion with Senator Estes Kefauver about this. And he actually had an interesting discussion where he said, look, we don't oppose giving this authority to second-guess the commander on policy grounds. We don't oppose that in principle. We oppose putting it at the Board of Review level. And he made clear that at the time there were six Army boards.
Well, is the gravamen of your argument that it wasn't really a court, it was a board, so therefore, well, does it then follow that in 1969 that would have dropped away sub silentio because it was now a court?
Well, no, Your Honor, because the Congress had expressed that power, and Congress didn't take that power back. But the question of, you know, why would Congress have given this to this entity and not to this entity?
Well, part of the answer given it, but specifically expressly denied it.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And part of the answer to that, Your Honor, is, well, at the time when Congress gave that power to the Boards of Review, that was a different animal. And it's also interesting to look at Major General Green.
Why do we have to regard it as a different animal? Is your argument dependent on that?
Oh, no, Your Honor.
Isn't it possible to look at the Boards of Review, the Courts of Criminal Review, and the Courts of Criminal Appeals as a continuous entity exercising the same power but for the change of may to shall?
Actually, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because you look back at the old language, each Board of Review was an independent entity, Your Honor. It wasn't one Board of Review that had nine people. It was three Boards of Review. And when Congress changed that in the Military Justice Act of 68, of course it set up a court. It had to deal with the issue of whether en banc reconsideration should be permitted. So we don't believe
my recollection is the en banc consideration was not in the 1968 legislation. It was in later legislation.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think because there were issues with the way it was set up as a court. I think that, you know, that's interesting from an historical standpoint. No, our argument does not depend upon any such distinction at all, Your Honor.
Isn't this fundamentally an issue of separation of powers? You have a judicial body which has arrogated to itself an executive prerogative, the prerogative of mercy, lodged in the executive in the Crown, lodged in the executive in the Constitution, and lodged in the executive in every state in the Union. Isn't this fundamentally a separation of powers issue?
No, Your Honor, because the Constitution, of course, gives Congress the power to make rules and regulations for the land and naval forces.
And Congress can disregard it as it pleases?
Oh, no, Your Honor. Congress executed its Article I authority when it gave the Boards of Review and then later the service courts the power to do what it did in this case. And there's no question that the government doesn't contest that the lower courts have sentence appropriateness power. It's interesting to look back at this court's decision in
Lane. Well, we drew a distinction in Ely between appropriateness and clemency.
But, Your Honor, it's interesting to look at what this court said in Lanford in 1955. And it said, is there a distinction between what a CA does and in clemency and what a Court of Criminal Appeals does in sentence appropriateness review? I'm sorry, a Board of Review does in sentence appropriateness review? And it said, not really. It said, if you define clemency as the power...
Well, that was 1955. And in Healy, which was post-1955, we seem to have said something else.
Well, Your Honor, but Healy was an issue... Really, the issue in Healy was whether a court of military review could augment the record to provide clemency. That was the issue in Healy, Your Honor. It was, you know, we know that part of the clemency function of a convenient authority is the power to consider issues from outside the record. Now, of course, Article 66C, the very sentence that we've been discussing, says that the Court of Criminal Appeals is constrained by the entire record. So that power doesn't exist, but Healy was really about the question, can a court of military review look outside the record to provide sentence mitigation? And the answer was no. But we think it's an interesting discussion in Lanford when they say, well, you know, what is the nature of this? And they said, if clemency is the power to treat someone with less rigor than the law allows, yes, Article 66C allows the boards of review to treat someone with less rigor than the law allows.
Okay. Does that extend to findings? That was a was that a sentencing case?
Healy, I'm sorry, Lanford was. Yes, Your Honor. Lanford was.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
So they're talking about sentencing here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now we're talking about findings.
But if one thinks that one is outside of the constitutional prerogative of the Court of Criminal Appeals, one would think so would be the other. We don't think either one is, of course. We think that Congress is constitutionally imbued with the power to over the land and naval forces, and they've given this specific authority to the Courts of Criminal Appeals. It's very similar to the authority that the Courts of Criminal Appeals exercise when conducting an unreasonable multiplication of charges review. It's very similar to that power to say...
And did Congress specifically give them that power, or is that a judicial construction?
That was a judicial construction.
Right.
Of course, it would have to be a judicial construction of the power that Congress did give, or the judiciary wouldn't be free to recognize that authority.
Was that a judicial construction, or was that a construction by the President of the United States in the Manual for Courts Martial when it was first exercised?
Well, Your Honor, it had been in the manual in the past, but of course...
I understand that change, but when
yes,
it was first established, was it not established as an executive power under the Manual for Courts Martial?
Yes, Your Honor, and of course that executive power was performed pursuant to Article 36, pursuant to a congressional grant, and of course when the President exercises powers under Article 36, as the Supreme Court noted in Lovin, he's wearing not only his delegated authority hat, but also his commander-in-chief hat.
Now, with respect to the powers of the Courts of Criminal Appeals, and this is not a question about the jurisdiction of our courts, it's a question of the powers at the Court of Criminal Appeals. Are the Court of Criminal Appeals limited in their findings powers, as they are in their sentencing powers, by a requirement to not abuse their discretion? I'll give you an opportunity to answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. I thought if I paused long enough, perhaps someone would throw me a lifeline. I am not familiar with any case that has addressed that issue, Your Honor. I think that issue would be one of first impression.
Well, is there any reason why if the defense argument in this case is that the findings powers should be construed similarly to the sentencing powers based upon the structure of the statute and the legislative history, why would Congress have established a system in which the Court of Criminal Appeals would be constrained as to the exercise of their sentencing powers, but would be free to abuse that discretion on the basis of race, religion, command, or any other reason with respect to their findings powers?
Okay, I have thought of a case that is closely analogous to that, Your Honor, and that is the Leak case, where this court said that when a court exercises its factual sufficiency powers under Article 66, that this court is not free to reassess the Court of Criminal Appeals' exercise of its factual sufficiency powers. However, this court can review what the lower court does for errors in law, and I'm conscious of Your Honor's question, saying not to get into jurisdiction, but I think Leak probably answers that question, Your Honor, that this court does have certain authority to review how a Court of Criminal Appeals carries out its function under Article 66C, but that power is the power to assess the manner in which the court made a legal interpretation. And so in this case, the only legal misinterpretation that the government argues is that the court didn't have the power to do what it did.
So do you dispute that is subject to review? That is, whether the action taken by the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case is subject to review by this court to determine whether it's within their authority?
Well, Your Honor, issue three in our brief argues that this court can review that issue, but this court doesn't have the authority to act on that particular finding of guilty. But that wasn't the concept that I was trying to implicate in my answer to Your Honor's question. But we have made that argument.
Right.
But that's
but
a
in terms
argument.
Again, in terms of the self-policing exercise of the power by the Court of Criminal Appeals, My underlying question was, are they constrained not to abuse their discretion? That is, can they determine on the basis of race, religion, command authority, et cetera, to change the findings or not change the findings in a case? Suppose they affirm a case. Again, not getting to your jurisdictional issue, getting to the exercise of discretion. Suppose they affirm the case on the basis of race, religion, or command statement as to how particular class of cases should be taken. They say this case is correct, in fact, in law, and we're going to affirm it as well because we believe that the command in this case has issued a certain command proclamation, and we're going to follow that and not change the findings. Can they do that?
The short answer to the question is no, they can't. And then the question, can this court do anything about it? The short answer to that question, Your Honor, is yes, it can. And the way it would do that would be to say that the court made an error in law. Because if the lower court does something on the basis of a forbidden classification, then that would be a violation of equal protection as brought into the Fifth Amendment under Billing versus Sharp.
So why isn't abuse of discretion an error of law? Isn't it typically treated as an error of law by appellate courts?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. But we also know that some issues are subject to an abuse of discretion review, and some issues are not. And again, I don't want to get too immersed in labels, although I guess this case is substantially about labels. But this court in Leak, again, we would refer to the distinction this court drew in Leak. This court in Leak used the word reassess to say what this court can't do. This court can't reassess a court of criminal appeals exercise of its Article 66C authority.
So with respect to the exercise of its discretion on the issue of findings on the should-approved area, while it may be that this court can't reinstate findings and can't say what the findings should be, is this court precluded from saying, you relied on command powers, you relied on race or religion, that's an inappropriate abuse of discretion as a matter of law, go back and do it again?
And of course, Your Honor, our argument is, of course, in issue three, we draw one distinction between Leak and what our view of the law should be. And so with respect to that, our answer would be no. But then to take it out of that and put it back into the other framework, in that instance, the court would be, we agree with the distinction that Your Honor makes, again, assuming the power. We agree with the distinction that Your Honor makes, I realize the question doesn't make a point, I'm sorry, but we agree with the point that is teased out by that question, Your Honor, which is that there is certain authority that a court has, that this court has, to say there was a legal error in the way you did it, do it again, and to say we're going to do it, or to say we're going to second guess your result, which again is what we think would be forbidden under the no reassessment language from United States versus Leak, Your Honor.
I understand. Although your time's up, my colleagues have other questions.
I guess a question that I have is how far is the authority of a CCA under the should be approved? How far does that reach? So, for example, if the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals decided that as a matter of equity that it was not right to charge people with consensual sodomy, and that they were therefore not going to affirm any of those findings, and on the other hand, the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals decided that, you know, for whatever reason, that as long as people are smoking marijuana in the privacy of their off-base home, that those findings shouldn't be approved, and so they weren't going to approve them. Do you think that they're authorized to make those decisions?
Your Honor,
under the plain language of Article 66.
While I don't much like this answer, I think the answer, Your Honor, is yes. And I think that gets back to the central point here, which is if it was unwise to give that power to the courts of criminal appeals, then Congress should take that power away from the courts of criminal appeals. If the government is dissatisfied with the exercise of the power in this case, its remedy is to go to Congress and say, take that power away from this court. Now, of course, we don't believe that any court of criminal appeals ever would take one of those lines, Your Honor, because it would be unreasonable, and because, as we've seen, the courts have been very reluctant to exercise this special authority that they have. And there's, you know, there's a reason why these individuals are selected by the Judge Advocate General and placed in these positions of authority. But again, if there is a concern about the unwise application of this power, the answer to that concern, Your Honor, is to eliminate the power, which is, of course, a function of Congress, not of this Court.
You may briefly conclude.
Oh, Your Honor, for the foregoing reasons, we would ask that the lower court's opinion be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efron, we agree that assuming that the courts of criminal appeals have this should-be-approved power over findings, that this court still can review that determination for an abuse of discretion. The two primary areas, obviously, our argument is not that they do not have this authority, but if they did have this authority, the two primary areas where we feel that the Court of Criminal Appeals erred here and actually abused its discretion were, one, they failed to give any sort of individualized consideration to this particular case. No matter how many times they used the word unique, basically they were concerned that this misconduct, this conduct that Congress declared criminal, was that the determination was wrong, and they took an axe to a statute that they did not like in the determination of what the age of consent is for child pornography purposes.
But what about the language, thus the appellant was in the unique position of having a relationship with someone he could legally see naked and but for his existing marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why isn't that individualized consideration?
Again, Your Honor, they might use the word unique, but this sort of misconduct occurs all the time and is prosecuted all the time. As cited in some of our published decisions from state courts and other civilian courts and news articles as well. So they really didn't give any individualized consideration in this case. They didn't look at mitigating or extenuating factors in this particular case. His service record, which, of course, was abysmal, so they couldn't look at that. So they did not grant that individualized consideration. They also focused on...
Would you address the contention of the defense that in Claxton we basically undid Waymeyer and gave it back?
Claxton was a very narrow decision, Your Honor. The specific holding of Waymeyer was that this should-be-approved language does not apply to findings.
Right.
The specific decision in Claxton was they may exercise this sort of broad discretion as to whether it applied waiver or not. Those are two totally different propositions, Your Honor. The second area where the court abuses discretion was in really solely focusing on the collateral consequences of the conviction, the requirement to register as a sex offender, which I might add was never really demonstrated before the court that somebody charged with Clause 1 and 2 violations under Article 134 would necessarily be required to register. There was no evidence in the record that he actually was required to register. But, Your Honors, I'd like to focus on a few brief issues implicated by the court's decision below, and I realize that some of these bleed over into policy or issues about how the decision was applied in this case, but I think they also apply into why Congress did not envision this power being granted to the courts. Is it logical that Congress would give a body authority to essentially overturn its own laws, legislating from the bench, with little or no review possible by this court? Is it logical to assume that Congress decided to abrogate?
If we have, in response to that, and this is a question, not a statement, getting to the second part of the issue, and that is abuse of discretion authority. If we have the authority to review these decisions to ascertain whether the court below has masked a case, that is, has decided a case on purported individual grounds when, in effect, it's decriminalizing a class of conduct. If we have that power, why doesn't that answer the question as to why Congress would have done this? That is it illogical for Congress to say, given the vast and not centrally controlled discretion of convening authorities all over the world, that they would anticipate that a centralized body would review these cases to determine whether particular findings should not be approved, so long as those cases were subject to further review to ensure that there's not an abuse of discretion in terms of decriminalizing conduct that Congress has criminalized.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would answer the question in part, but part of the issue raised by the court's decision below is they really give no standard as to how this exercise, this power is supposed to be exercised. I mean, one would think that the next step is...
the intention of the defense that it's a standardless power?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the contention.
That it's a council of revision?
And is it really logical to assume that Congress would give this one body, this particularly unique authority? I mean, presumably they now have the power to essentially legalize marijuana. Is that the next step? Because it's not fair that 18-year-olds in the civilian community don't get prosecuted for this, but 18-year-olds in the military do. That's the real implication of the court's decision below. What standard are they supposed to use, and what review is possible by this court? Those are the central issues in this case.
Counsel, although your time is about to expire, you may take the time you need to summarize and conclude your case.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Air Force Court greatly exceeded the scope of its authority under Article 66. Congress never granted the CCAs the power to become a super-convening authority, legislating from the bench and guided by only their subjective sense of right and wrong, subject to very little review. This is judicial activism at its ugliest, and it is for these reasons that the government respectfully requests that this court reverse the portion of the Air Force Court's decision that set aside the conviction for possession of child pornography and affirm the findings and sentence as approved.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess pending further order of the court.